we are in the middle of football season. Oh, yes, I know. You know, at every football game, players and coaches from both teams are interviewed. Before the game, they'll say, oh, we need to play 60 minutes of good football. There's no easy games. We can't afford to overlook today's contest. At halftime, they interview the coaches, and they say, well, we need to play more consistently if we want to win. We have to make more stops on defense. We have to score more points. You know, really intelligent things that they're saying. And then after the game, you know, the commentator is there saying, well, what do you have to say? And they say, well, we're really proud of our guys. They really played their hearts out. They left everything out on the field. And the game was a lot closer than the score would indicate. Whatever. You know, Denver hosts the Rams today, and I can tell you right now, before the game, what the score is. Before the game, the score is 0-0. Okay, see, okay, bad. Now, calling the game, or calling the score, is a whole lot easier from the end zone after the game is over. And you got it up on lights on the scoreboard. It's easier to look back in a game and in life and see what you did right or wrong. One writer said that Paul was standing in the end zone of life. I'm not sure Paul understood all the football analogy there, but in the end zone of life, looking back over the game that he played. His ministry is over. There's nothing to look forward to but his execution. He knows his time is up and wants to give one interview before he leaves. One opportunity to write a challenging epitaph of his life as he looks back at what it is now, what it has been over the course of his years, and what still is future. Now, how many messages have you heard that have the three points, you know, the past, the present, the future? That's a typical outline of many messages. But in this case, it's the present. Then he looks at the past and the future in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6, 7, and 8. That's our text for our message today. Because we want to start out and look at what is happening in the present. Paul says in 2 Timothy 4, verse 6, for like a drink offering, I'm already being poured out. Now, we're familiar with offerings, you know, where you kill an animal and you sacrifice it, you put its blood on the altar, you put its body, you take the fat, and others, you know, you cut up different portions. Some are whole sacrifices. But a drink offering was a little bit different because it was simply poured out either in front of the altar, on the altar, or even on the sacrifice of the lamb or the ram or the bullock or whatever it might be. In history, we're told that the Roman Empire, at their families, at the end of every meal, whenever they gathered together for their big family meals, they would take a small cup of wine, and at the end of the meal, they would pour it out as a tribute to the gods. That was their offering. Well, in the Bible, they've been doing that since the days of Abraham and the patriarchs. If you read in Genesis chapter 35 that Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he'd spoken with God, a pillar of stone, and poured a drink offering on it and called it Bethel. It was formalized in the book of Exodus when Moses gives the different offerings that were to be given in Exodus 29:41. He said, when you offer a lamb, offer 2 pounds of fine flour mingled with 1 quart of oil and 1 quart of wine. And so this was a typical way that they poured it out. They would take the quart or whatever it is of the wine, and they would pour it out. There was no reservation. There was no waiting for another time or let's just pour a few drips on it and drink the rest. It was a sacrifice that they gave. And Paul said that like a drink offering, I'm being sacrificed. Paul's individual sacrifice is very much akin to what Jesus did. You remember the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 53, we often read it at communion time, but he said at the end of that chapter, I will allot the Messiah a portion with the great because he poured himself out to death, numbered with the transgressors, bearing the sin of many. And so Paul says, I'm a drink offering poured out. And he explains why by starting this verse with the word for, F-O-R, saying for, because of why Timothy needs to be sober and do the ministry. If you read back in verse 5 of 2 Timothy chapter 4, we spoke on last time, he said, Timothy, you need this. And so he's saying, for, because this is the reason, this is the explanation, I'm already being sacrificed. He wants to pass the baton to Timothy, and he wants to encourage him in the battle and to look at him exemplifying faithfulness. But Paul's saying, I'm already sacrificed. And I thought, no, you're not. You're in prison. You don't know when you will die. You'll be called out one day. The sentence will be fulfilled. You'll either have your head chopped off, which is the typical punishment of a Roman citizen, or if you were a military man in Rome, you were simply thrust through with a small, short, thrusting sword and disemboweled, literally. Just that's how two ways that you'd be executed. Or if you were a non-Roman or a non-soldier, you could be crucified, you could be hung, they could do anything they wanted to you to fulfill that punishment. Paul says already, because folks, Paul's head was not yet on the executioner's block, but his heart was. He lived saying, I'm already dead. What can they do to me? The I here in the sentence is emphatic, confirming that he's saying it's a done deal. He said, I'm already, it's happening. I'm being poured out. That might not happen for months. It might happen the next day. Paul didn't know, but he was a sacrifice. A few weeks ago, we remembered the sacrifice of so many in the New York Fire Department as they rushed to save people in buildings in the Twin Towers. And I mean, there were hundreds of people who went up. They were given an order. Nobody really thought the Twin Towers would come down like they did. But every fireman knew when he went up into this blazing fire that it could be his last step. And for every one of those men and women, it was. See, they chose that when they took the oath to protect and to serve and to help others in the New York Fire Department. And so Paul is saying, I don't know exactly how the sacrifice is going to happen. I don't know exactly all the details. That's not the issue. I'm a living sacrifice. I made the commitment when Christ called me to be his child and to be his servant. He said, I'm willing to count myself as dead. Having been made, how is it? Phrase in Romans 12, to being made conformable to his death. And so if you tell God that you're ready to be his servant, Lord, I'm willing to do whatever you want to do, then what are you going to do when the consequences happen that are not everything you wanted? Private or public, it will cost. And there's no self-pity when the fire begins. I wrote in my notes here that this is a transaction of the will, not the sentiment or not the emotion. It's a transaction of the will, saying, Lord, I'm willing to be your sacrifice. So, like a drink offering, Paul says, I'm ready to be poured out, and the occasion for my departure has arrived. This is the the time, the hour, the period of life. He said, it's like the sands in an hourglass. I asked my wife if we had an hourglass I could set up here and then turn upside down so the sand started out all during the sermon and you could see how it was going. Yeah, she came up with an egg timer. I said, wait a minute, it's 3 minutes. Yeah. the timer is, the sand is running out. The stages of life, Paul says, okay, I'm at this stage of life. I thought, I asked, what are the stages of life? You have an unborn baby. Oh boy, you feel it kick. And then you have the newborn. Oh, isn't that just precious? And then the toddler who gets into everything. And the child, then the school age. They start going off to elementary school and learn from all the evil children there how to behave. And then a preteen, and then a teenager, then a young adult, and a middle-aged adult, and a senior citizen, and a golden age. Somebody said that. I'm a golden age. Listen, I can relate to the mineral idea because I have silver in my hair and gold in my teeth, crystals in my kidneys, iron in my arteries, sugar in my blood, titanium in my joints, and lead in my pants. But that's another story altogether. The idea, some of the children are saying, are we taking notes on this? No. You know, he said, this is your kid. He said, this is my life is moving on. And it's like Paul's at the airport. Yeah, if we think he didn't know about NFL, you'd imagine he didn't know about airplanes. At the airport, and it says, okay, final boarding call. And he didn't want to miss it. I have a book in my library on the final words of great men and women. An entire book. Because in older times, people died at home. They died surrounded by their family or friends. They didn't, in large, they had a chance to say final words, to talk to people and have them written down. Mahatma Gandhi wrote, he said, my days are numbered. I won't live very long. But for the first time in my 50 years, I find myself in a slough of despond. Everything about me is darkness, and all I want is light. Elvis Presley's last words, I'm going to go read in the bathroom. I thought, wow, that's an exciting last words to go on into history. I can't read what W.C. Fields, some of you know W.C. Fields, great comedian, but every other word I have asterisks in my notes because that's what he thought about death. And Humphrey Bogart, his wife Lauren Bacall left the room and he was dying. And he didn't say, here's looking at you, kid, which would be really cool, his famous line. But he said, goodbye, kid, hurry back. And when she came back with the children, he was dead. You see, the wicked is thrust down by their wrongdoing, but the righteous have a refuge when they die. Folks, that's my new life verse, Proverbs 14:32. The righteous have a refuge when they die. Adoniram Judson, the first Baptist missionary from the U.S. to go off into India and then to Burma, and he was on his deathbed. He says, I'm not tired of my work. I'm not tired of the world. But I'm ready for Christ to call me home, and when he does, I'll go with the gladness of a boy bounding away from school. And I thought, oh yeah, I know that feeling, that final bell comes and you skip on out and you never look back. He said, the occasion of my departure has arrived. The word depart is an odd word because in Greek it's analusa and it means unloose, and it even sounds like it does in English. But Paul said in Philippians 1:23, I'm hard pressed in both directions, having a desire to depart, to be loosed from this, and to be with Christ, or to stay here and be with you. It's a tough choice. 2 Corinthians 5:1-2, he said, He said, we know that if our tent of our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, but eternal in the heaven. And for this we groan, longing to be loose. Paul doesn't use the word death. That's not going to soil his lips by talking and saying death. But it, because that word falls like ugly clods on a coffin. But instead, like every language, he has euphemisms for it, where he says, I'm poured out, my departure. These are terms, we use that, don't we? We don't talk about death, we talk about me passing away, crossing Jordan, going over to heaven, kicking the bucket, or whatever gracious thing you have there that, you know, we just use as these phrases. But in history, this word talked about unyoking an animal from the plow or the cart, of loosening the chains and the bonds, of letting down the camp tent, saying, okay, let down the ropes. Let's unloose them. As Robert E. Lee said in his final words, strike the tent. That was it. Casting off the mooring ropes, because precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints, Psalm 116, 15. So, that's where he's at right now. Now we come to 2 Timothy 4, 7. Because these famous words, and you've heard sermons, you've heard them, you know these words as well as I do. I fought the fight, finished the course, kept the faith. Just that simple. He says, I have fought the good fight. The word here is to agonize. How do I know that? It's because the Greek word is the word agonize. Okay, I think we got that one down. He said, we're not on a playground, we're on the battleground, and we're going to fight. We're gonna recognize there's a battle here between our old fleshly being and the new spiritual born-again soul that we have inside. The tension and the struggle to stand boldly for truth and stand boldly against evil. Because Satan is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Man is not the enemy. He didn't fight the fight against man. He fought the fight against Satan, against evil. Man may be used by the enemy for Satan's purposes, maybe a tool in the devil's hand, maybe speak the devil's words and do the devil's business, but we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, authorities, cosmic powers in this present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil. We don't need to waste our time and our energy trying to combat one another. We have a great enemy out there. And Paul says, I agonize. It's a battle. I fought the fight, not just the fight, the good fight, the right fight. Ephesians 6:10 says, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. For Galatians 2:20 says, I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, it's not I who live, but Christ lives in me. You see, we are in a battle. Our enemy is not another nation. Our enemy is not the next door neighbor with the yapping dog. Our enemy is not someone of a different political persuasion. Our enemy has nothing to do with color or race or ethnicity or gender, height, or if you're not tall, what do you call that? Littleness. I don't know. I've never had to worry about
short
that.
In stature.
Pardon?
Short in stature.
Short in stature, yes. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, right? He liked to play the game all the time with the wee. Though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. 2 Corinthians 10:3 says, for the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but we have divine power to destroy the strongholds, the arguments, the lofty opinions that raise themselves up in opposition to God. That's the battle. Carnal people use carnal weapons. The stinging arrow of gossip. The cruel spear of personal attack. The sharp swords of threatening words. The harsh whips of cowardice or deception. We put on the armor of God. Defensively, the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, shoes, shield of faith, helmet of salvation. We take offensively the sword of the Spirit, praying because we're in a battle and it's hard work. He says, I fought the good fight. He looks back and says, secondly, I've completed the race. I'm not a quitter. I think about that because I used to race. I don't know, were any of you in school in track or field or cross country or something like that? Okay, two people here know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I mean, I can remember wanting to quit. You know, even today, I go out to go jogging, and 2 minutes later I return home because I forgot something. I forgot that I don't like to jog and that my lungs hurt, and so I don't do that. But, you know, this is what, you know, every muscle strained, every lung panting for a breath, continuous, one direction, running the course. Paul uses this as his favorite metaphor. In Philippians 3, he says, I forget what's past, I strain forward to what lies ahead and press on to the goal, the prize of the upward call of God. Acts 20:24, I don't count my life dear or any valuable, but to finish the course. 1 Corinthians 9:24, don't you know that all people run in a race, but only one wins? So I'm running to win. I'm not just running to get a participation medal. Hebrews 12:1, therefore, since we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let's lay aside the weight that besets us and run with endurance the race that is set before us. You see, races were the big thing, and distance races, the long, hard, grueling race. In the Aegean Sea, off the seacoast near Athens, the little seaside town of Marathon, there was a huge battle of the Athenians against Darius I of Persia, and they lured his big ships into shallow ground, and if you're into wars and battles, it's really cool. The people in Athens were fearful of what would happen because if the Persians landed, they knew they would come in and sack the city and enslave all the women and children after killing all the men. The general at Marathon sent three runners to go to Athens and give them the great news of a victory. One runner fell by the wayside, exhausted. A second runner wandered off course. And some of you have raced and know what that's like too, because it's 26.2 miles from the sea level at Marathon up to the mountain top of Athens. 26.2 miles, rough terrain. But one runner gave it his all and rushed in, went down to his knees, and said, victory, and fell over and died. He'd expended all his effort to give that one message. By the way, we still run marathons, don't we? We don't do it on a nice level track. We do it up and down hills, 26 miles, right? Just like they did at this first race. Each of us have a race to run. We're not competing with each other. We're not trying to look at others, because when you take your eyes off of the road, if you're like me, you find yourself on your hands and knees all skinned up, laying down in the dirt somewhere because you can't keep your balance. But each one of us has an individual course that God has given us. Think of this, how great that is, that God planned out a course. He knows exactly what is hard, what is easy, the difficult time, the uphill slog in there where you just don't think you can take another step, and the downhill where you're kind of just skipping along and it's not so tough. He decides how we run, how long we run, how far we run. And all he asks is that we stay in the lane that he put us in and run the race. You know, God is not going to ask you to be responsible for anyone else. He's going to ask you how you ran the race. Now, the scary thing is, for Jim and I as elders in the church, God is going to ask us how you did, because you are our responsibility. Looking at Jesus, but careful, recognizing that the race is there. So, he said, I've fought the good fight. I've completed the race. It's literally the word course, like the lane there. And then finally, he says, I've guarded the faith. You want to look at my life in the past? He said, I handled with vigilance the work God gave me to do. God gave me a message. He said, preach this message, and that's what Paul did. He didn't preach ifs, ands, and buts. He didn't stammer or hem and haw. He simply proclaimed the truth. We have churches today where the truth is not being proclaimed. People say they want to be politically correct. They don't want to offend people. I read the story this morning. I read it to my wife, of a woman in Massachusetts. And she said she found out she was pregnant. Already had one child. They didn't have enough money. They knew it would be a hardship to have a baby. They knew that it would create strain on their relationship, and they just didn't have it planned right now. So she said, I did what God wanted me to do. I aborted the baby. And I thought, my goodness. And then signed her name. It's a picture of her in her robe. She's a Baptist minister. And I thought, God gave us truth. God gave us his word, doctrine, the whole thing. Not just love one another, which is an important thing. Not just preach the gospel, but the whole body of truth of his word. And we act like the German soldiers in World War II, who just before the Battle of the Bulge, when the Americans thought they were just going to march right through Europe and after D-Day and had come down and liberated France, and now they were going to go right through Germany, and they're just waiting for the weather to clear up because it's nasty. It's kind of like it is out there today. And they didn't realize the Germans were hiding tens of thousands of tanks and artillery and military unit waiting for just the right opportunity, and then they were going to smash right through and divide the Allied lines. But before they did that, the Germans found members of their army that spoke good English. They dressed them in American uniforms and sent them undercover to go and do one thing: change all the signs. If it said this town is this way, just move it around, put the arrow going the other way. So that if the Allies were trying to fight back or whatever, they'd look and go, oh yeah, we got to go this way, and they'd go into a trap, or they would be heading the wrong direction from helping or aiding their friends. We have no right to change the signs of God's word. We have no right to say, well, I don't agree with that, or I don't like that, so I'm going to just change it. We proclaim not ourselves, 2 Corinthians 4:5, but we proclaim Jesus as Lord. We have a sacred deposit given to us, entrusted to us, so that we might in turn give it to others. And then when we reach the end of our journey, we'll just still be holding on to the message, unchanged, not just with our hands, but with our hearts, where we stand for truth no matter what. Now, is the world going to give us a good time? Is this going to be a happy life? We've got no problems whatsoever because we serve the Lord, right? We'll never have a difficult time. Well, wait a minute. I like nice green fields. I love flowers. I actually do. I mean, when we go on trips, we stop and smell the roses. We love flowers. I was in Portland this summer, and man, they had a rose garden there with more roses than I've ever seen in one place in my life. Just huge. And but not many flowers can grow where people wrestle all the time, where they fight, where they run track, where the lone sentry's beat back and forth comes guarding. See, that's what Paul says, that's what he did. You don't have many flowers there. It's a tougher place. And so I ask myself, is life a desert of disappointment and woe? Or is it just kind of an obstacle course? A gymnasium, a place where we can work out and learn, where we can find help in the storms or the hurricanes or the tornadic winds of life. You see, for Paul, the sun was setting and the night was setting in. But he looked up and the sky was red. Because red sky at night, sailors like, next day's going to be great. Okay, I'm going to die. I'm going to be poured out, probably stuck with a sword or my head shot, blood all over. He says, okay. I've fought the fight. I've run the course. I've kept the faith. I can do it. And of course, that leads us to the final part, the future, in verse 8. For what's remaining, Paul says, or some of the older translations would have henceforth something or other, and he's basically saying, what's ahead? He said, what remains reserved for me is a crown of righteousness. Now, victory in itself is a great reward. I was in a struggle. I was on a ship in the middle of the Caribbean. And my wife says, why are you getting up early? And I said, because there's a trivia competition at 8 in the morning. And I'll eat early breakfast, then I'll come back and we'll eat late breakfast, and then we'll go to mid-morning tea. And anyway, that's another story, because we try to do 10 meals a day on a cruise. But I was in this struggle because I had to get up and because the championship of the ship trivia was taking place. And every day of that cruise, they had held up this trophy of a ship and the ship name on it. And it said champion or victor or something like that. Or maybe it just said the ship name on it. But a beautiful trophy. And I wanted that. I was laboring for it. That's, the victory, doing good would be good enough. But boy, it's nice to have a trophy on your bedstead. And if you come by my house, I'll show you the trophy. It's made of plastic. Not, they probably make them by the bajillions for every carnival ship of the sea. But that's what I labored for. Well, what's remaining? A ship on a stick. A trophy? I might not even get, I don't even know about trophy. I just want to hear well done. Right, Brother Robertson, isn't that what you preached on last week? God gives us talents and says, use it, and you'd use it, and he says, well done. That's what Paul said, that's what I want. I don't want a medal, I don't want a trophy, I sure don't want a plastic ship. Because payday is not down here. Payday is coming. He said, what's coming is a crown. Not talking about the crown of the diadem like a king would wear, or even the crown that was made for the head of the Sanhedrin. Paul was in charge of the Sanhedrin. 35 Pharisees, 35 Sadducees, they got together and they had one man in charge. And that was the Apostle Paul before he was saved. About as high up in Judaism as you can get without being in the family to be the high priest or whatever it might be, but in charge, he was it. He knew about the crown. But he was looking forward to the victor's crown. Henceforth is laid up for me, reserved for me as a crown of righteousness. A crown signifying I completed the course. I kept the faith. I fought the good fight. It's not the word diademos in Greek, which means crown. It's another word. It's the word stephanos. It's the little laurel leaf things that they put on a victor in a race. It would last for a week or two and then would just dry out and be worthless. But at that moment, that was what it was, the stephanos. And I'm thinking, yeah, Paul, who was in charge of the Sanhedrin, the first time he heard the gospel message was by a young man named Stephen. And Paul didn't even dirty his hands by picking up a stone. He just walked on out in charge. They all laid their robes and their coats at his feet. And he stood there and watched as 70 Jewish leaders stoned Stephanos to death. And Paul said, I'm looking forward to the Stephanos. I'm sure he remembered. How can you forget something like that? You see, well, it's been 35 years since he was saved and all of this. And he knew. This word didn't slip by him. As he said, reserved for me is the Stephanos of righteousness. You see, that's the crown that we're working for. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9:25, athletes do it to obtain a perishable wreath. We do it for an imperishable. In Revelation chapter 4, verses 10 and 11, in the scene in heaven, the 24 elders fell down before him who was on the throne and worshipped him who lives forever. They cast their crowns. You see, we get there. There's going to come a day of reward, and we're going to get these crowns. They're saying, we're not worthy. All we did was what you asked us to do, Lord. They take their Stephanos off their heads and throw them at the feet of Jesus and say, only you are worthy. That's what I'm looking forward to. Reserved for me is a crown of righteousness. Culminating, the Lord, the righteous judge, will reward me in that day. I'm not worried about what Caesar gives me because he's going to give me a sword. I'm not worried about what Nero might say or the summons to execution. I'm going to stand before a totally righteous God and he's going to look at my heart. He's going to look at the motives because my actions sometimes fail. But he's going to look at my heart, Paul said. In standing here on the verge of eternity, Paul says, I'm just waiting for that day. The award ceremony's coming. This is so exciting. He's not waiting for the day he dies. He'll go and be with the Lord. But that's not the day of rewards yet. That's not till the end. But he says, on that day, literally capitalized the word day, that day of God's judgment. You know, I don't see any excitement. I don't see any tears. I don't see any emotion or tremor or stoicism or anything. He's not playing a part. He's not pretending. He's saying, okay, I'm 70 years old. I've done what God wanted me to do. And I get to die. He wasn't worried if he didn't get a crown because he knew that God would be just in it. He didn't worry whether somebody else would get a bigger crown than he did or if the Lord was disappointed in you. Somebody asked me, they said, are you a Calvinist? And I said, yes. God loved me from all eternity. And he said, can you imagine that? God's been disappointed you forever. He's been disappointed with you forever. And I thought, I'm not sure you're catching on to what we really believe, you know, in, when we say that. Don't worry. Ignore the speculations. Keeping your eyes focused on Jesus. And not just Paul. He ends us with the wonderful little extra phrase about the crowd. He says, not only to me, but to everyone whose love is appearing. Paul doesn't want to stand alone. That's the worst thing that could happen for him. You know, if he was judged by earthly standards, He was a pretty great failure, wouldn't you say? I mean, here he is, the leader of the Sanhedrin, and he turns his back on the power, on the authority, on his stature and his position, and becomes a Christian, the kind of person that he killed. He suffered the loss of all things. He couldn't be a member of the Sanhedrin without having a male heir. But he said, I've lost. He said, you don't have a husband or a wife? Be like me. I've lost it all. He exposed himself to a lifetime of sorrow and toil and work. And the less he was loved, the more he loved. It'll be worth it all. Because he knew that when the door opened up from his dungeon and all he was to see out there is a scaffold, he knew that when that door opened, the next door would be the door of heaven. And he'd see Jesus. The promise is for all of us. God wants us to live. You say, well, he's an old man now. He's getting kind of schmaltzy and probably cries during the illustrations. I've got one coming that I'm working on, not crying. No, he's a Christian who loves the Lord, and his heart is tender and touched. And he anticipates the future, but he doesn't want to be there alone. He wants to stand with others that have come to know the Lord, others in the churches that have been strengthened and grown, others who were little children, and then years later he saw them as teenagers and then adults and starting their own families and their own life. This is what I want to be with. Not to me only, but to all who love his appearing. No one stood with him. No one was there. But he knew that at the final step, the final door, there would be others there with him. In conclusion, I want to tell you a little summary of the story of William Borden. In 1904, William Borden, now when I say Borden, what does that come to mind?
Milk.
Milk, right? Borden Dairy. Billionaires in Chicago. The family had been saved under D.L. Moody and were attending the Moody Church where R.A. Torrey was the pastor at the turn of the century. William Borden was given a world cruise as a graduation present from high school. It's nice to be rich, okay? He traveled around the world, and everywhere he stopped, he saw people, their temples, their shrines, their mosques, and none of them knew the gospel. They were all going to hell. He wrote back from India and said, "Dear Mom, I think God is calling me to be a missionary." When he got to Hong Kong on his world tour, he sent his mother a final letter before heading back across the Pacific and to the U.S., and he says, "I know God wants me to be a missionary." So arriving home, 18 years old, he went to Yale University for 4 years. He went to Princeton Seminary for 3 more years. And when he got to seminary, his family said, "I want you to drop out of school and come run the business, because we are millionaires and the business is going downhill if you're not here to help the next generation." And he wrote back. He said, "No reserves." He said, "I don't need money. I don't need anything else. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to serve God where he wants me to go." No matter what they did, they realized he was going to go to the mission field of China, and nothing could stop him. He got on the ship, age 25, headed out of New York, said goodbye to his family, said, "I'll probably never see you again, because I'm going to give my life for God as a missionary in China." He was a missionary to Muslims in China. Difficult, difficult field. 25 years old, and he headed off across there. And in the back of his Bible, where he had written the word "no reserves," he wrote the word "no retreat." No retreat. No matter what might happen. A few days after his 26th birthday, his ship landed in Egypt, heading over to China. While he was in Egypt, he contracted cerebral meningitis and died within 2 weeks. The world, which had kind of taken up his case, because, I mean, this is like the famous, you know, just like the famous family, the Borden family. Their son's given up everything, given up all the wealth, and heading off to be a missionary. Can you imagine that? The newspapers got a hold of it, and they posted all sorts of articles saying, what a fool, what a waste of life, dead in Egypt. After his death, his family received his personal items in a steamer trunk. And in them they found his Bible. And in the Bible they found these words: no reserves, no retreat. But in the Bible were also added two more words that he wrote in the final days of his feverish life, as he lay dying half a world away from the mission field. He'd written, "No regrets." That's what I want my life to say. Did he live a great life and go and serve God for 70 years? He ran the course that God gave him, which is different than the course God gave me or you. Without reserve, without retreat, without regret.